Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, on the night of November 8th, 2016, many writers and journalists were preparing pieces on what it would mean for the United States to elect its first woman president. Those works obviously didn't make it to print. Writers Samita Mukhopadhyay and Kate Harding took in that moment, then decided to create something from it. They curated an anthology of 23 essays titled Nasty Women: Feminism, Resistance, and Revolution in Trump's America. Contributors include Rebecca Solnit, Cheryl Strayed, Samantha Irby, Nicole Chung, and Katha Pollitt. This Nasty Women book tour event was presented by Town Hall Seattle in partnership with NARAL Pro-Choice Washington at Seattle First Baptist Church on October 10th. Mukhopadhyay and Harding joined Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo in discussion about the book and what's next for feminist activism. Sonia Harris recorded the discussion. Please note, this conversation contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Thank you all so much for coming out. This is amazing. I love seeing so many faces here to talk about this book and kind of the subject matter around it. And I just, as a lifelong Seattleite, it's always wonderful to see audiences come out on a Tuesday. I almost said Monday, because I've been operating like this is Monday all week, because I'm a writer and I don't leave my house. So it could be Saturday. It's the same significance to me. But it's wonderful to have you here. When I first was asked to discuss this book, knowing it came from Kate, whose work I've followed for a while, I was like, oh, okay. And you know, the subject matter for me, the title for me, I am not part of the Pantsuit Nation. And then, of course, the email followed up with, and these are the writers that are in the project. And I was like, oh, wait. And I'm so glad I took a look. I'm so glad I looked at this project, because it's such a wonderful book. It is such a beautifully diverse book. And I don't mean that in like the weird tokenism way. I mean diversity of thought, as well as, you know, the intersectionality represented within. So I am super honored to be asked to host this discussion and to be able to kind of help introduce this book to many of you. I know that this book just recently came out, so a lot of you haven't had the chance to read it cover to cover, and I hope that you will after this. So we had a lovely introduction, and I do want to thank our hosts. First off, I would love to thank Town Hall for having us here.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, I would love to also recognize the somewhat historic space that we are in, and thank this lovely church for hosting us and allowing us to be here as well. I would also like to acknowledge the land that we are on, in the Duwamish land, and also I would love to thank NARAL for their lovely opening comments as well. So all of that, I want to take a moment to just recognize that. All right. Okay, that's about as spiritual as I get. I don't have much more in me. So I would absolutely love, first off, to just kind of talk a little bit, and we had introductions, but I would love to kind of hear in your own words kind of who you are. We'll get in a second about like what brought you to this project, but just kind of like what brought you to this space of life in general. So whomever wants to go first, Kate or Samita.
Who am I? Why am I here? Well, I'm a late 30s single woman in Manhattan. So I've been a feminist activist for 20 years, I would say. I have an undergrad in women and gender studies, which is actually where I met Jessica Valenti, who's the founding editor at Feministing. And so in the early 2000s, she invited me to join writing at this thing called a blog. And I was like, what's a blog? which I think kids today are probably asking the same question. Really short period of time where everybody had a blog and then we got book deals from those blogs. imagine saying that to your agent now. So I became a writer in the mid-2000s and got involved in kind of specifically women of color's experiences within the political system. And so I, you know, at Feministing was the voice that was like, we need to talk about Oscar Grant and we need to talk about intersectionality and we need to talk about Kimberly Crenshaw, and kind of had a moment once where I have a master's in transnational feminist theory, and I was trying to explain it to my mother, who's a working class immigrant from India, and realized that she didn't understand any of the theory that I was reading. And I was like, my life's project is going to be bringing this very difficult to access theory to someone like my mother. And that is how I ended up in kind of journalism and doing more mainstream work. And so I have a book out called Outdated, Why Dating is Ruining Your Love Life. It came out about 6 years ago. And then this project, which we'll talk about in a moment. So.
Wonderful.
And so I also come from the blogging world, and that's how I knew Samita. I got started, I was always a writer, and in fact, my degrees are in English and creative writing. And I had very little training in women's or gender theory or gender studies. So I learned a lot from the feminist blogs, like Feministing, as I was starting out, and I was just reading them at the same time that everyone was like, you're a writer, why don't you have a blog? So I was like, well, I'm gonna start a feminist blog. And my focus was something that was largely missing from the feminist blogosphere at the time, which was fat politics. Which has since been taken up and beautifully owned by Ijoma's sister-in-law, Lindy West. So I'm sure you all know her. And when I saw her come along, I was just like, thank God, I don't have to do so much work anymore. And she's terrific. And I am, so I'm the married white lady, so I am like the Pantsuit Nation demographic. And although I wasn't totally into that, I was very much a Hillary supporter, which was an interesting thing to be when you move in this, in feminist circles, which, you know, she was very much seen as insufficiently radical, which I can agree with, and we can discuss that. But I knew coming to this book, like, there was no way, I didn't want to do Pantsuit Nation the book. Like, first of all, somebody else is probably doing it. And second, that's not the feminism that matters to me. Like, it was meaningful to me in many ways to think about electing our first woman president, but that wasn't all it was. And it wasn't all of the suffering that came from seeing Donald Trump going to the White House. And so Samita and I started talking almost immediately after the election. And you can go into your little story. Oh, can I just say, though, because I wanted to say before I forget, that the one other place that I wanted to thank, because I am representing the capitalist demographic, is Elliott Bay Books, who hooked up with Town Hall and helped make all of this happen, and they will be selling our books, so thank you very much for that.
Yeah, so if you want to talk about the origin story?
No, I'm going to skip that segue completely, just leave it hanging. No, I'm just kidding, please.
Okay, so the night of the election, I was working in a newsroom, and I had filed a 2,000-word piece to my editor about the historic moment of the first ever woman president. File it to my editor and get in a car and go to the Javits Center waiting for history to be made. I mean, I had been crying for the last 3 days. I had so many friends on the campaign. I was, you know, I worked at a millennial outlet called Mike.com, and every one of my colleagues was a Bernie supporter. So I was like that old shrill feminist in the newsroom that was just like, no, but Hillary. And, you know, and I, obviously we know how the night went. I did not publish the essay, and what I thought was gonna be an after party, turned out I had to go back to the office and ask, what predominantly, you know, at that point my staff was queer, young queer people of color, fighting back tears for what just happened, to have to basically write in, you know, on our website, Donald Trump was projected to become the president. And so that entire process was unbelievably emotional. And so the next day, they had me do a video where I talk about it and I'm like crying, because one of the things that I had thought about was if a young girl is born right now, she would have been born into the first ever woman president. Kate sees this video of me crying on the internet.
It made me cry.
And she literally leaves a comment. She's like, I bet there's an anthology worth of those essays. And I was like, I bet there is. Let's turn that into something.
Oh, that's amazing. I was just thinking, like, I bet, like, it would be weird to have, like, just a week of, like, let's just publish what we think we would be writing right now. Because as a writer, you feel there's so much you have to write. And it's the worst. Like, you're not having fun anymore at all. Like, you don't get, like, lighthearted moments to write about jokes. And of course, it still wouldn't have been all fun and games had the election turned out differently. But I like to imagine the other things I could be doing. And so many other of my fellow female writers and trans writers and disabled writers and queer writers could be writing right now if it wasn't, please don't let the world explode, oh my God, please. I think it would be a fun writer vacation to be like, no, let's imagine that this isn't
the alternate universe.
What are our problems? What are we thinking about now other than, you know, impending doom?
It would be like, this historic decision on choice where we have repealed the Hyde Amendment is great, but does it go far enough? Yeah.
Exactly. Like, exactly. Exactly. So I actually did want to talk a little bit more about, like, the origins of this project because, you know, I think everything was a whirlwind post-election. I think a lot of people were shocked and stunned and kind of were grasping. How did you come together? Because I'm looking at the timeline, having just finished a book. And I'm like, I don't know how this happened so quickly. Because I wouldn't have finished my proposal by now, let alone had a book put together. What was it like to be going through all of that shock? And what was your kind of frame of mind putting this all together, reaching out to people, getting all of that done?
Speak to that. I was so upset and just in shock that I needed something to put my energy into, and that's what this project really became. And I also knew that other people felt that way, so it would be a really good time to get them to commit to something that they might have said no to a month later, because everyone was like, we need to do something right now. And I was like, hey, Cheryl Strayed. We have a thing you can do right now. So it was actually, surprisingly, overwhelmingly, everyone said yes. Actually, we couldn't even accommodate the number of people that wanted to have essays in it. But, you know, as you mentioned, we're very particular about the perspectives that we wanted in it. You know, as Kate likes to say, she's like, I capped the white women. Like, we had to, like, we were like, okay, and now, you know, it was really important that, and the other thing I was really feeling, I was really in my feelings about a lot of different things on the left, and I wanted to have a set of essays that really reflected the fragmentation as much as this kind of cohesive, like, oh, we're all upset that Hillary lost, but actually instead, like, this revealed all of these kind of bruises on the left that we really wanted to kind of have articulate words around.
And also, even though it did come together very quickly in publishing terms, but literally, you know, fortunately, we had an agent who knew an editor who was very interested right away. So, I mean, we had this sold by the end of November. And then we had assignments out, and sort of hilariously, our first deadline we gave them was like January 15th. We wanted essays in before the inauguration. And between depression and just the reality of those timelines, that didn't really happen. But so they took until about March. And what we really wanted to do as people who have published a lot online and done like the hot take factory was give people some breathing space to write something more nuanced, more thoughtful, put it through a round or two of editing, really kind of just, you know, even though it seems like no time compared to when you are literally on a deadline where it's like, all right, I need something start to finish in 2 hours, you know, giving somebody 2 months was an incredible amount of breathing room. And so it was important to us to get that and also to, you know, we got people that we wanted to represent specific identities or cover specific topics, but then gave them a great deal of freedom where, you know, Sumita earlier was like, yeah, we messed up. We don't even have lesbians in the book. And I was like, yes, we do. We just don't have an essay about being a lesbian. And like, it was important to me that we weren't just asking people, like, you know, write about that identity that we pegged you for, but that it was just a matter of, you know, in 2017, like, we were just talking earlier about how we're getting frustrated by every journalist is asking us, like, how did you put together such a diverse roster? And it's like, A, Samita's been doing that professionally for ages. Like, that's what she does, is find journalists of color and pull them in. And B, we were like, we're not gonna do a feminist anthology and not have it be intersectional.
I mean, you act like that's not novel, but
No, I know. I like to, and I say this about like the way that I approach rape culture, which is one of my big subjects too, is that I like to talk in that, like, we've already decided on this. Like, this is a settled question. Like, feminism needs to be intersectional. And if you're just hearing that for the first time, well, come on, catch up. I mean, but I should also say it took me a while to get there. So I don't want to act like I have known this from birth. I had to be taught and chastise a bit.
Yeah, and you'll see in like a lot of the reviews, people are surprised. I think they expected it to just be this like Hillary redux. And then when you get through all the essays, you're like, oh no, this is like a set of really critical perspectives that don't all, not everybody in the book was a Hillary supporter necessarily, but they all recognize that Trump is bad.
It's a pretty low bar.
Yeah. But someone did ask us, they were like, did you consider a Trump supporter? I was like, absolutely not. Like, they have the White House. Like, yeah, they don't need to be in my anthology. Like,
I was sitting there putting on my thinky face, like, well, let me give you a thoughtful answer. And I was like, no.
Yeah, one thing that really I was pleasantly surprised by was seeing some names I recognize that I've loved for a very long time as writers, but I hadn't really considered writers of whose wheelhouse hasn't always been really political as far as their work. Thinking of like Sam Irby, yeah, who is inherently political in just being an incredibly honest, queer, fat, black woman, but in that sort of politicalness of, yeah, I'm gonna show you the mundanity of my day and you're gonna actually see how queer, fat, black women live without any apology, but not necessarily, she's not publishing essays about politics. And in fact, throughout most of the election, you know, it was, she continued writing about her life, which I think in a way was actually incredibly revolutionary. And also seeing Nicole Chung in there as well, who I have worked with at the establishment as an editor, and I primarily know her as a really talented editor. And it was really fun to see their pieces and see a different facet of them. Nicole's piece was beautiful and heartbreaking, and I highly, highly recommend, well, read the whole thing, but also, like, slow down when you get to Nicole's and spend some time. And Sam's, I mean, I love everything Sam. Sam's the funniest writer in the world right now. If you're not following Sam Irby, Bitches Gotta Eat is the name of her blog. It's the best thing. If you're ever having a bad day, I alternate between that and The Toast, like Archives of The Toast, to put me back. But
where Nikki Chung was an editor.
Yeah. But did you reach out to them? Did you see possibility of that in their work? Because oftentimes, once you get stuck known for doing a thing, nobody thinks you can do anything else.
Right. Well, both of those were mine, actually. And that's where my literary background comes in handy, that I was just like, I want writers I love who I know can write killer essays, where Samita knows all the super political children that I don't. You know, I'm like, I can't bring you anybody under 35, but I can bring you. And also, I'm from Chicago, so I know Sam Irby personally, and I've kind of seen her come up, and just exactly what you said. She's the funniest writer working, period, and we knew that humor was going to be an important thing that we wanted in here. We didn't want it to be so serious, but it's also really interesting that you pull out those two, because those were the two who tried to say no. And fortunately, I knew them both well enough to say, no, you don't get to say no. And Sam's was specifically like, what? I don't know anything about politics. You know, she always does this pose where she like pulls out, like, I didn't even graduate from high school. And I'm like, listen, I get that. And I can get like that somewhere under that, you are genuinely kind of intimidated by fancy political thinkers, but also A, you're a better writer than 99% of them, and B, just what Ijeoma said, that, you know, your writing is inherently political and you don't have to sit here and make some massive political statement. you can just write about being you, and that is a political statement these days.
Yeah, I also feel like, I mean, I know she did that Times op-ed a couple of months ago that was about being poor, and one of the things, like, one of, like, the reasons I was really attracted to her as a writer, and I've followed Bitches Gotta Eat forever, and she also has a book out
called
the most recent, We're Never Meeting,
In Real Life.
Hilarious, right? She's so funny that, like, now Kate and I have been traveling together for a while now. It's been a week.
And it's been several years.
It's been years. And every time I'm laughing at my phone, she's like, are you reading Sam's Facebook page again? Because literally, she's that funny. But that I think one of the conversations, and I talk about this in my essay that came out, was this intersection of class over here and then like identity over here, and kind of like gender or racial identity over here, whereas they are obviously very overlapping. And I always felt like she, as a writer, without even trying to, writes about class in a really profound way, that I think a lot of self-proclaimed lefties have never even heard of her or wouldn't even know. So that was important, I think, to have her there.
And it creates another level of accessibility where it's, you know, kind of like slipping in your vegetables when she's so funny and not overtly political and not at all academic that people can pick up points from that where they might reject somebody who takes the more kind of like, I'm going to teach you how things are tone.
Yeah, she would be so embarrassed right now.
I know. I'm She'd glad like, there's video.
What are you doing? I'm sending her the link to the audio of this just to ruin her day.
We love you, Sam.
we are doing an event with her in Chicago.
Oh,
which
nice.
We're very excited about.
You should play part to the audio of just us.
Oh my God.
Talking about her.
We're gonna
I don't
do
know
that.
If you guys, if this is what you signed up for, but guess what? It's right. Samantha Irby hour.
That's your new favorite writer.
I actually think this would be a great time if one of you wanted to read a bit from the book. Who volunteers to go first?
I volunteer you because you're just sort of the
You're closer.
okay. So let's see. Holding a mic and reading at the same time. This is going to be awesome. Okay, so I wrote the first essay in the book in lieu of an introduction, and I think really what inspired me to write this essay was the conversation I saw happening about identity politics after the election, and this kind of swing on the left to move away from identity politics. And so basically what I write about is the case for why we actually need them, and it kind of is why we picked the essays that we picked in the rest of the book. After Clinton lost the election, criticism of her campaign's approach came swiftly. In a much-discussed op-ed for the New York Times, Mark Lilla argued that American liberalism has slipped into a kind of moral panic about racial, gender, and sexual identity that has distorted liberalism's message and prevented it from becoming a unifying force capable of governing. Lilla's views were reinforced by liberals, also warning of the electoral consequences of following Clinton's strategy. In a Washington Post op-ed, John B. Judas wrote that the left overestimated the strength of a coalition based on identity politics. Echoing similar sentiments, Senator Bernie Sanders regularly criticized Clinton for failing to focus on issues of class. We need a Democratic Party that is not a party of the liberal elite, but of the working class of this country, Sanders said in March. It's not good enough to say, I am a woman, vote for me, he said at a rally in Boston after the election. What we need is a woman who has the guts to stand up to Wall Street, to the insurance companies, to drug companies, to the fossil fuel industry. Sanders was not wrong in suggesting we need more than token references to identity to galvanize authentic support from voters, but it's important to remember that most identity politics are about class. And Clinton did talk about class during her campaign, about equal pay for women, paid family leave, increasing the minimum wage, a fair tax system, and revitalizing American manufacturing. Exit polls also failed to substantiate the claims that Clinton's campaign didn't speak to economic anxieties in the electorate. Black women, the poorest demographic in the country, voted for Clinton at a rate of 94%. According to analysis of exit polls by the New York Times, 53% of Americans making less than $30,000 a year also voted for Clinton, versus 41% for Trump. In those same exit polls, 52% of voters who listed the economy as their top political issue of concern voted for Clinton, as opposed to 42% who voted for Trump. To suggest that progressives move away from identity politics in the service of a broader American narrative is also to suggest we ignore the heavy-handed role that sexism played in Clinton's loss. In both her 2008 and 2016 presidential campaigns, people critiqued her voice, her demeanor, and her appearance. She was considered untrustworthy, while her opponent, who wouldn't release his tax returns, the first candidate ever to refuse to do so, was supposedly a straight-talking, no-bull breath of fresh air. The press and the public became fascinated with Clinton's private server and leaked emails, both used to bolster the argument that she played by her own rules. Meanwhile, Trump was caught on the record repeatedly lying about everything from the unemployment rate to his own tax plan to ultimately refusing to disclose his own tax documents. But Clinton's critics persisted. They just didn't like her. Lost in the hubbub of the debate on the left over identity politics was that Trump, too, ran a campaign based on identity. But it was white identity and white fear. During the election cycle, he deflected criticism of racialized language as unnecessary political correctness, a derisive term used to describe liberals' attempts to express sensitivity towards minorities. An outgrowth of identity politics, political correctness has become an obsession of thinkers on the right and the left, who are focused on the impact of PC culture. Or rather, on students running amok on college campuses demanding gender-appropriate terminology, who have simply hamstrung the progressive movement. Left-leaning writers have caricatured prior to the 2016 election safe spaces and trigger warnings as evidence that today's college students are intellectually coddled. New York Magazine columnist Jonathan Chait called PC culture exhausting, that being held to the standards of political correctness is difficult and ineffective and therefore tiresome. These critiques first came from staunch conservatives. In his 1998 book, Illiberal Education, author Dinesh D'Souza argued that political correctness impairs free speech, preventing society from talking openly about brutal truths. Trump built his campaign around speaking those brutal truths, which gave way to the rise of the alt-right and other white ethno-nationalist sentiments in the 2016 election cycle. He stoked fear of the other when he proposed a ban on Muslims. Oh, is it boring? I'm just kidding. That's how I feel when we keep talking about the election.
Right, I know.
Sorry. He stoked fear of the other when he proposed a ban on Muslims entering the United States. He aggravated class anxieties by insinuating illegals would take jobs and used the fear to push forward the idea that we need a bigger, taller wall to keep Mexicans out of the country. As Leila Leilami argued in the New York Times, Trump won the votes of the white majority on a campaign that explicitly and consistently appealed to white identity and white anxiety.
Wonderful. Did you all ever see the movie Untamed Heart? No? Yes?
Who's in that?
It's amazing. Marissa Tomei?
Yes. Yeah.
Rosie Perez? Christian Slater.
Is Christian Slater? Okay, yeah, I did see that a million
years ago. He's got the baboon heart.
Uh-huh.
So this is relevant, trust me. There's this scene where Rosie Perez, they work at this diner, right? And she has like this like gross sexist boss who's like, they're trying to gossip and he wants him to work. And she says, you are like wet sand in my underwear. And Jonathan Chait is like wet sand in my underwear. Oh. And every time I hear his name, I go,
I almost did the same thing where it was all I could do not to interrupt you. It's so funny that you
didn't ask. I made a little face.
I was like, what political correctness is, I'm like, Jonathan Chait is exhausting.
Yeah, he is thoroughly exhausting. Anyways, I just wanted to leave you guys with that in case. In case you weren't familiar with Jonathan Chait or in case you needed an apt description for Jonathan Chait. That's one. So, thank you for that. Yeah. I think that was a wonderful introduction to not only like the piece, but also kind of where we are now. So I think this is also a really good time to kind of segue into how this piece can be perceived now, because I think we are in a time where I wouldn't say this is necessarily unique. It seems to be, I was actually just ranting for 45 minutes last night on Facebook about this. It isn't unique for many on the left at every defeat to figure how can we be less left every time, and who can we kind of chuck off this ship in hopes of keeping it afloat instead of shoring up the ship. And what seems to be this time is just a whole scale attack on the concept of identity politics and intersectionality. And I find it quite interesting to see a book like this around the same time, too, that I'm regularly being sent, like, horrible articles about why intersectionality is the death of everything. And we need to just get back to the days where you could show up for the one issue that you cared about and then go home and not care about anything else. How do you think that this work stands now, as opposed to where it stood when you were conceiving it, unaware of what the next year would bring? It feels like it's been 1,000 years and not 10 months, but you know, I think we know a little bit more about what this looks like.
I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not, as a freelance writer who's been kind of out of the loop lately, nobody is emailing me stuff every day. I felt like there was an immediate backlash from guys like Chait and Lilla, and I mean, Dinesh D'Souza is always gonna Dinesh, but that, like, especially these, like, moderate presenting white guys who are old enough that they've been through a few cycles like this, and so they thought, you know, this is what you do when the left loses, you write your article about how the left needs to be more moderate and more centrist. And so it felt like there was a whole ton of that noise immediately, but there's so much pushback this time, where I think, you know, especially among younger people who were really mobilized in this election, going at it saying, like, you know, no, we want to vote our values, which are way to the left of mainstream politics. So that gives me some hope that there was more pushback to that narrative than there usually is.
Yeah, I would say I have trouble finding people that agree with Lilla openly, but I think that it's more subversive in when people say, like, we need to, like, focus on, you know, a cohesive identity on the left. And I think what's hidden in that is this kind of assumption that Americans have this unified experience. And I think that, interestingly, you'll see, like, Republicans love to promote women. Like, they love to get a woman as high as they can, even though it's a token reference. I think sometimes progressives get caught in this trap where they're like, well, we don't want to be tokenizing, we want to really, like, they're, like, so caught up in the myth of meritocracy that it's almost like, look, we tried to, like, have a woman win as a political strategy, it didn't work. So, like, let's just, you know, like, we should have never given you money. Like, it's literally that attitude. And I think that, frighteningly, not only has nothing changed in the last year, I don't think the left has absorbed any of the lessons, like, perfectly, frankly, but white identity is a very strong organizing factor right now. You have Nazis that are marching in the streets without their faces covered in this historical moment in, you know, support of white purity. If that is not identity politics, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm. Good
job. Yeah, I think... We both very much come from a place of all politics is identity politics, and that's the end of it. And I think to try and make an argument otherwise is to deny reality. You don't actually get to opt out of these identities if you have marginalized identities. The people who get to opt out and pretend they have no identity are basically white cis men, white cis straight men. And so they're the ones, largely, who are writing this stuff about, like, well, maybe this has gone too far. And it's like, yeah, that's because you get to pretend that, you know, you are this kind of objective, identity-free being, and not that, like, people who look and act and sound like you have been president for the entire history of this country.
Yeah, and to respond to your also the kind of backlash between intersectionality and identity politics, I think there's a misunderstanding of what those things mean. You know, identity politics doesn't just mean, like, have me up here because I am a brown woman, but don't listen to my words. It's, you know, it's really, it's a way of looking at policy, right? So the environment is an identity-based issue. Communities of color, specifically indigenous communities, are the most impacted by, say, by the Dakota Access Pipeline, right? That's an intersectional way of looking at a policy. That is a identity way of looking at a policy. You cannot look at criminal justice reform if you're not looking specifically at which races are disproportionately impacted by that, right? And so what does that make us as progressives, if we say we don't want to take those things into consideration? What does that mean? What does that mean for our policy?
And it's what was so frustrating about the obsession with the white working class right afterwards, where it's like, you know, this is an identity group, and they have legitimate grievances that liberals should be addressing, but there is a working class that goes way beyond white people, and why are we suddenly obsessed with the economic anxiety of this one racial group when class issues, you know, affect everyone? Yeah, I'm getting yelly.
None of us can pay our bills.
Right, exactly.
I think, you know, it's interesting. I was actually saying last night, I think a lot of what we like to assume in what we like to think of as expediency is that we can bake a cake and kind of substitute for these poisonous ingredients, thinking that in the end, if we can ice it nice enough, it's not going to make us sick. And we consistently compromise what are actually core values that we say that we believe in, which are things like equity and justice and equality. Those things are not negotiable. I mean, in their nature, they're not negotiable. Like, equality is not, you can't be like 20% equality. That, like, just the math doesn't work. And so if that's the thing you want to claim and you want to rally behind, and I also think if that's the thing that you want to get people excited about, you can't at the same time then go, okay, equality here for now and not here, but we're going to call it equality, because that's just not how words work. And I think that what we have time and time again is those who are in charge, and in all movements, it will be the most privileged. Right? And I'm not just speaking in terms of race, right? Even within, you know, within anti-racist groups, within Black Lives Matter groups, even though groups founded by women, we oftentimes find that we get in there and it's going to be like a black dude that's like, hey, I'm in charge of this thing. You will find that the first sacrifices are always made on the backs of, you know, the least empowered and the least privileged within those groups. And what I like about collections like this is sitting with different perspectives around a similar event. So we all see these things and we go, okay, well, this is what it looks like for different people. How are you hoping in the general dialogue moving forward, right? Because I think we all do have a lot of pain that's going to be with us, well, you know, for 4 years at least, of how this all turned out, no matter how you wanted to vote. I don't think anyone in this room, no matter how you voted, I'm assuming if you voted for Trump, you're probably not here. I'm gonna be safe in assuming, no matter how you voted, this is not a good political time for you. You are not happy with how things are and how they look to be in the near future. So while we all have open wounds that are gonna be open, for a very long time, it's hard to heal from something that's still happening. Also, there is a sense of moving forward and looking at the now and you know what needs to be done with the present horrific reality as it is. How are you hoping that this book kind of fits into that?
Yeah, I really appreciate the way you asked that question, because we keep getting asked, like, what is the path forward for America? And I'm like, that's why I'm a writer, because I don't know. I mean, the hope is exactly that elevating this. So one of the things I am feeling so much as someone who is so deeply embedded in both journalism and activist communities is the trauma that we went through in the election, and that when we talk to each other, we are not hearing each other. I am immediately triggered when someone says certain things about the election the way that they happened, and they're like, you are a sellout, and I'm like, you are a sexist, and it's just like this like infinite loop, and I'm like, you support racists, and they're like, I am so you know, it's just this awful kind of loop that's happening, and then we keep like re-performing it, this kind of almost ritualistic trauma at this point of what happened in the election. And my hope, and you know, I know Kate says as well, is like stepping back and letting other voices kind of speak what they're experiencing right now, and that for us in on the left to hear each other's voices, to have a moment of like, oh, okay, like maybe, you know, you make this like strategic political decision, but the bigger, you know, our bigger interest is actually much more shared. And then I also think it's to help give people who feel really beaten down right now some courage and some talking points when they are talking to their family that's not quite as supportive of their political beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, I think Samita talked about wanting to kind of represent the fragmentation of the left, and I think that's something that we wanted to do with, I mean, not to use a totally hackneyed metaphor, but to present it as a mosaic. Because I have come to, you know, especially as someone where I was a staunch Hillary supporter on Twitter, which meant a lot of Bernie supporters were just like, you can drop dead. And I mean, I get it. It was mutual. And because, and also Twitter is just such a toxic environment. But we sat there and said, who are the people we know who were big Bernie supporters who had major reservations about Hillary and are also great writers who can really do this in a way where they're thinking critically? And so we've got Collier Meyerson, we've got Sarah Jaffe, Meredith Tolusin, sorry, I had been saying that wrong in my head for years and then I actually met her. She's, you know, she was writing very critically of the Women's March and of the whole, like, kind of pantsuit nation phenomenon and all of that. Where I'm like, so this can, we can all be in this respectful, it's not even necessarily respectful dialogue, but a respectful series of monologues that you can see as part of a whole. Because I've been talking, people keep talking about unity on the left, and I'm like, I don't know if what we need is unity so much as for all of us to just be moving in the same direction in our own little kind of narrow fields. And I think that's always going to be the case, where there are always going to be people who are most focused on reproductive justice, there are people who are most focused on Black Lives Matter, there are people who are most focused on LGBT or LGBTQ plus I, sorry, I worked at a school last year and it was just called the LGBT Resource Center, so I said LGBTRC so many times that I started to say the R and tripped. but people are going to come at this with all sorts of specific things that are their focuses. And we've always been doing that. And we've always been like, all right, well, sometimes you annoy me, and sometimes we don't agree exactly on how to approach this. But we know we're all operating in good faith, and we're all trying to get over there in our own ways and pull each other along when we can. So that's what I would like to see more than all of us like sitting down, hashing it out, like, okay, who was right about 2016? Would Bernie have won? And a lot of people, you know, we need to stop acting like we can't move forward if we can't get everyone to kind of agree on an answer to that.
Wonderful. Well, I think we're actually just about time now for our Q&A. Don't be all Seattle about this, y'all. You know better.
Can I start with a question? I'll start with a question. What would you three say to teachers who are feeling pressured to be neutral in the classroom in front of their students now?
I quit a job at a university because I couldn't stand having to pretend to be neutral. I wasn't teaching, I was working. In a resource center. I was in the Women's Resource Center, so we were the WRC. And we had an explicit social justice mission, yet heard within days of the election that we had to be careful not to alienate the Trump supporters who were feeling very attacked on campus. And I was like, you know who's feeling attacked? Probably the kids who are worried their parents are gonna be deported, you know, for starters. And so the idea that I wasn't allowed to actually prioritize the most threatened students and their needs and their emotional health was just so anathema to why I took the job in the first place that I was like, I can't do it. But I mean, other people aren't as flexible as I am or have, you know, are much more embedded in their careers there. And it's very hard because you do have, you know, who knows if a kid is recording something and taking it back to their Trump parents and their Trump parents, Trump supporting parents.
Who knows if you're about to be content on Breitbart.
Mon pa Trump, yeah, so that, to exactly that, to be, I had a, sorry I'm rambling, but I spoke at a university a couple of weeks ago and a woman came in, said, is this where the feminazi's reading? And set up a camera at the back.
Hitler was a notorious feminist, by the way, just so you know. That's where that came from. Hitler, total feminist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why we are feminazis, because, you know, Hitler, did a lot for women, that guy.
I mean,
that clip is going on Breitbart. But so, knowing that this woman came in with this attitude and a camera, I was so rattled, and it's probably the worst talk I've ever given, because I just kept thinking, this is going all over the, like, men's rights activist internet, and I just lost it. There's a very real fear of what can happen if you express an anti-Trump position, opinion in public, or even in the semi-public setting of a school. And I don't know. I tell a lot of stories. I don't have an answer.
Yeah, I would say, and interestingly, I was a public school teacher very early in my career for 5 years. I remember I was very political. I was part of this group called Teachers for Social Justice. And I think right now, first of all, is like an opportunity for all of us to show moral courage in a moment that is going to be remembered in history as a very, very dark time. Like, I don't want to underestimate that. So I would encourage us to be as courageous as possible, as is possible within your means, and what the repercussions are going to be, only you know that. Also, the teachers that I remember the most in my entire career are the ones that stood for something, and specifically the ones that stood up for the voiceless. So that's
all. I know, I'm definitely, that's wonderful. I'm the mom of two school-age kids, so I've got a 11th grader and a 4th grader. And so the day after the election, I was in the schools, meeting with dean students, meeting with the head of the diversity for the district, and we were talking about this while we literally had students, especially at the high school, crying in the halls. Students whose parents were undocumented, who didn't know if their parents were going to be deported. Trans students who had just been very excited about, like, the high school kind of, like, they had the student-led, like, bathroom diversity relabeling project, and we're suddenly feeling, so crushed. A lot of our children really feel like we've really fucked this up for them. Like, they can't vote, and they're just looking around like, who? Like, my 9-year-old, we have a neighbor who's a Trump supporter, and I used to catch him just staring out his window. Like, you. I think, though, the cool thing about teaching, and I'm going to speak specifically to primary teachers and high school teachers, where I think it is incredibly important, these are the people who are going to be inheriting all of these decisions that we're making now, is to remember that our job right now is to kind of preserve what they knew before we started teaching them other things. And they fundamentally knew issues like fairness. Have you ever cut in front of a kid in line? Like, these things matter so much to them, and we consistently tell them that it doesn't. We tell them to suck it up, and life isn't fair. Sometimes you don't always get the right thing. Why are we teaching our kids these things? Why are we teaching them? That's how you end up with kids who look at injustice and go, sometimes some people just lose out. And that's not true. We need them throwing those flopping on the floor fits about everything that's unjust in the world throughout their entire life. Because where we need it now, it's not happening. And I think the lucky thing about school is, honestly, if teachers are honestly holding to the ideals that they say they have as teachers, it's incredibly political. And you don't even need to make a speech if you just do the things that you actually haven't been doing enough of, that you should have been doing all along, which is affirming the identity of all of your students. You don't even have to make a political speech, but when I have teachers who have who are afraid to say this was a black inventor, because the word black gets stuck in their throats, they're not actually fulfilling their regular duties that they should have, no matter what the politics are, of actually recognizing and seeing diversity in the world, showing children that people of any circumstance, any color, are all capable of doing amazing things and contributing. When we don't see any stories with any disabled kids and things like this, these are all things that they can do. You don't even have to make a political statement. Just actually adhering to the things that we all say our teachers do, which is supposed to be loving these children equally, seeing these children for who they are, recognizing their potential as children, creating spaces where they are, safe from bullying and harassment. All of that is everything Trump hates. And you don't even have to say, I hate Trump. If you live like that, you can't love Trump. And you don't even have to say it. And you just have kids who will wake up appalled, and they will vote accordingly if that's what's normalized in their environment every day. So it's not even that hard. It's just, it takes just start recognizing what you actually haven't been doing that you should have been doing all along if your teacher's in this room.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This Nasty Women book tour event was presented by Town Hall Seattle in partnership with NARAL Pro-Choice Washington at Seattle First Baptist Church on October 10th. Thank you again to Sonia Harris for our recording. You can hear the full recording on our website, kuow.org. Tune in again soon.